Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors. Asking the questions no one else asks. Creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And the question that arose to me, John, and I went out to find somebody who could talk with us about it, was what will the changes be in our healthcare system as a result of the pandemic? So will we get more serious about public health overall, the social determinants of health? What about the cost of care? What about telemedicine? Is that going to be expedited by years? What about licensure for people who are out of state? When you look at New York, which is really tough on licensing and regulation, and when they were really in the hot spot as it relates to COVID, they said, hey, we don't care where you're from, Arkansas, Mississippi, we need your help. So we have made a lot of changes in response to the pandemic. Will they be long lasting, John?
Well, personally, I think we should start it right here to get it on the initiative on all ballots that anybody in government have the same medical care that they produced so that they can see how bad it is, because it's bad.
Is that like the president saying, you need to get COVID so you really understand it?
Yeah,
of course,
right.
That was after
sort of the same.
Over 200,000 people were dead.
Except
you could
don't
have just
COVID.
Asked Dr. Fauci and gotten the same information. But, John, one of the things is that a lot of people, I would imagine, are retiring from healthcare, and we're going to have perhaps some void because there are a lot of doctors and nurses, including your wife, who are just on the cusp of retirement. And this might have pushed some people right past that.
Well, you're right. And I don't think Medicare, from what I've seen, is everything that it should be. So, I mean, we're really in a pickle. I mean, would real competition help the insurance market for everybody? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but we need to do something about insurance in this country, because we got such a screwed up system.
Oh, we really do. And we've talked about that in other podcasts. We deal a bit with that, but we deal also with what are the impacts on rural hospitals and other hospitals going forward as a result of this? What about primary care? If you read a lot of the literature today, it has also taken a massive, if less noticed, drubbing during the pandemic. So we wonder about that. Telemedicine, as we said, going mainstream and the impact of that. Will we invest more in public health? John, that is such an important area. I think people don't quite understand how different clinical health is, where you and I go to a doctor individually,
right,
as opposed to this public health system, getting the right vaccinations, making certain the different populations who are more remote from the healthcare system somehow get their needs met as well. So there's so much to this that we're going to have to look at again, rebuild. But you're absolutely right. The financing and access to the system are going to be important as we go forward as well.
Well, plus the government screwed up in another way. They required, they didn't want to deal with Medicare with single doctors. So now they're forcing these doctors, if you want to have Medicare, to go into these large groups. I mean, now these doctors are working for some big organization, and they're becoming robots because they got to see so many patients a day. I mean, we've really found a way
absolutely
to screw up such a great medical system.
Well, you know, I went to see my doctor recently, John, honest to goodness.
Yeah.
And so I said to him, gee, we haven't been together in a while. This is my internist. I said, how have you been? He said, well, once I recovered from COVID,
oh my God,
my doctor who is very healthy, because of their interaction with so many sick people, he said in his office, so many people got it. And this guy is healthy.
Wow.
He's really vibrant, very athletic.
You forget
and
about
he
that.
Said,
these people are on the front line.
Yeah. He said it was a living hell. Yeah. And he has changed his whole outlook on a range of things. Yeah. It's pretty remarkable when your own first line of defense goes down. Well, we're also going to be talking about drug makers. We're going to be looking at a whole lot of issues related to healthcare and the system that emerges in the wake of this pandemic. And those of you who have been on the front lines, we thank you. You
yes,
have been absolutely remarkable throughout. And we're going to be calling upon you because I don't think this is by any means the end. I don't think we're turning the corner.
No.
And if we are turning the corner, we see the same monster looking at us on the other corner.
This is going to be around for a while.
Absolutely. So thank you again. Let's talk about healthcare costs and healthcare overall with Ariel Kane from the Progressive Policy Institute today on America Trends.
Welcome back to America Trends. With me on the line is Ariel Kane, and she is the Director of Healthcare for the Progressive Policy Institute. And Ariel, you know, there are very few things that Americans agree on. We know that these days. Democrats and Republicans seem to have gathered together around some criminal justice reform. But if there's another issue that they're looking to find common ground on, when you see that 92% of all Americans want changes in the healthcare system. This issue of healthcare, its cost, access, the ways to navigate it, all of them seem to be very troubling to the American public.
Yeah, I mean, I think the number one concern for everyone is just how much healthcare costs. And because it's so expensive, that creates barriers to accessing it. You see that time and time again bear out in polls, and when people talk about health insurance or surprise medical bills or any of those issues, the root of the actual problem is the cost of healthcare in the United States.
So if that is the root of it, I know that we've heard many times, well, we're going to drive down the cost of prescription drugs, and that in specific seems to be of great concern to many Americans. Why have we been unable to get our arms around these issues?
Well, I think when you're trying to do anything that disrupts 20% of the economy, it's inevitable that you find some level of resistance. Everyone points to high healthcare costs, but no one wants to take accountability that their service or that their product is the reason we have such high costs. And so you kind of, you know, have everyone pointing fingers at someone else and things don't really move.
Well, I have one of my doctors who I go to for a specialty, and he admits to me that there are just way too many hands in the cookie jar and too many people who are gaining great financial benefit from the system. So tell us, what was it that under the Affordable Care Act, we were supposed to have seen as a result of that effort, and why we haven't seen it perhaps?
The ACA did a number of things around healthcare costs. First, it tried to make insurance more affordable, which means that it, you know, provided subsidies to people in the individual market. It expanded Medicaid to new groups of people who were previously ineligible, and it went after the donut hole in the Medicare prescription drug program. However, all of those things sort of moved costs around and changed who was ultimately footing the bill, but didn't go after the root of the problem, which is high prices. And so in the United States, we have high prices across the industry, and that is why health insurance is so expensive and why prescription drugs are so expensive and, you know, why you find people then subsequently struggling to pay for insurance.
I saw you on a video that was on YouTube talking about the all-payer rate setting moves that have been going on, particularly, I believe, in the state of Maryland, and you think that might inform the process. Explain to us what that is.
So, in Maryland has two things that it's done that's different than any other state. First, it has all-payer rate setting, which is that it, regardless of who your payer is, if your payer is Medicare or Medicaid or a private health insurance company, the provider gets the same price for the service. So that really changes incentives because in many other states, what you see is that commercial insurance reimbursement rates are much higher than Medicare rates. And that means that commercial insurance is much higher. However, when they did that for a long time, like multiple decades, and they still weren't seeing that their overall costs were going down. While the cost per service was indeed lower, providers were giving more services per patient. And so the overall costs in Maryland were no different than any other state. And so in the last couple of years, they've also instated a global budget. And that means that all providers are also agreeing to not increase their expenditures year over year above a certain amount. And in doing that, Maryland has been able to both be more flexible in what it puts its dollars towards and bring down the cost overall for the state. And building on that point, I mean, I think with COVID, we all saw unexpectedly all of these healthcare layoffs because people weren't getting what we call elective procedures, which basically just means anything you can schedule. People weren't doing that. They were afraid to go to the hospital because they didn't want to contract COVID or also use services that should be, you know, PPE and such that should be directed towards providers helping patients with COVID. And so as a result of that, we saw huge healthcare layoffs across the country, which you wouldn't really expect in the midst of a public health crisis. Except in Maryland, because Maryland has that global budget, their funding didn't change just because people were getting fewer elective procedures. And so they were able to sort of stand out from the rest of the crowd and do better, you know, while everyone else was laying people off.
So Maryland, of course, a lot of the same providers and same insurance companies that we have in other places are there. Did they fight this or did they support it? Did it have bipartisan support? And did some consider this price control and that was going to drive down quality? I'm sure there were many arguments. Tell us what the debate was about in Maryland and whether that debate about this global pricing is happening elsewhere.
They first passed their all-payer rate setting back in the 70s, and in the 70s, Medicare and commercial insurers weren't reimbursing at such different rates that they are today. Today, the average commercial reimbursement rate is 240%, so 2.4 times the Medicare rate, and that was not the case back in the 70s. So while, yes, all of the things that you just said are arguments that are used against all-payer rate setting and global budgets, it wasn't as fierce back then. And then I think that, you know, that of course, providers are not, like, keen on cutting their budgets. That's not what they want to do. But I think there was a sense of we're all in this together and what we're doing isn't working. And, you know, there was a moment to sort of set an example or make progress. And so while, yes, of course, there's some level of political opposition, they were able to bring everyone along and pass this pretty transformative way of paying for medical care.
I know that we have a movement called health citizenship where people are saying, you know, this is my right. This is not something that I choose. When we come with a body, when we're born, we need to make certain that it gets the care that it requires. And if you look at 69% of the people before the COVID-19 feeling that they were stressed as a result of healthcare, why is it, do you think, that Medicare for All has gotten some traction, but not necessarily the traction that some of the numbers about feeling the need to change would suggest?
I think it's a lot of things coming into play at once. People are always afraid of the unknown. If your health insurance is working for you, which a lot of people say that it is, even if it gives them anxiety, what's more worrisome is what might come next. The other thing is in the ACA, there were included caps on your annual limit. And so meaning if you're a person who has insurance that's regulated by the Affordable Care Act, which not every health insurance plan is, but most are, you have a cap on your out-of-pocket expenditures each year. In Medicare, as it's currently written, that doesn't exist. So while, yes, Bernie Sanders' version of Medicare, you know, would cover everything, Medicare, as it's currently run, has 20% copays on hospital stays, and there's no cap on that. And so people buy supplemental insurance. So they buy Medigap, what's called Medigap plans. And so I just think it's not as simple as it's been made out to be. And because of all those various unknowns of what we would end up with, you know, sick W no versus the W don't.
And as a result of the COVID-19 crisis, where a lot of people were separated from their jobs or artificially retained until we know what the economy's future status is going to be, and the government encouraging that payrolls not be depleted, or do people feel the same way about employer-driven healthcare? I mean, I got to be honest with you, Ariel. I've never really understood why we thought that was a good idea. I think we're the only ones in the world that tie health and employment. And that was a way, right around World War II, to give extra benefit when more workers were needed and there were some controls on wages. So I don't understand why this relic retains such enthusiasm, if it does.
I think if we were designing a system from scratch, that's probably not what you would design, but it's past dependence. It's where we found ourselves. And, you know, a lot of people aren't, not everyone, but a lot of people aren't clamoring to move away from their generous employer-sponsored insurance when, you know, the alternatives are the individual market, which isn't great. And even with the ACA, which made it infinitely better, but it's still not great. It's still very expensive and confusing. And, you know, or if you're low income, you get Medicaid. Again, if you live in a state that expanded it under the ACA, otherwise there are other ways you can get Medicaid other than just being low income. So there's just a lot of things at play. I mean, I think you're right in that if we were designing it today, we wouldn't necessarily design the system, but this is where we ended up. And some people wanted to continue. Industry, of course, like this is, they've made a business around the system and, you know, this is the path they cater to. And then, you know, people as well, like not everyone wants a government plan, whether or not that's in their own self-interest, you know, I'm not here to decide, but that is the reality.
I understand. And let me ask you this, because you did bring it up, and I thought that was a very important distinction. When Bernie Sanders was talking about Medicare for All, it's not a Medicare for All that anybody over 65 today would recognize, because there are, as you say, copays, deductibles, a whole range of things. And the private industry, the private insurers are still much involved. Is that likely to be a hybrid that more people can get their arms around, where in fact there can be differentials in terms of the coverage based upon what you can afford, but everyone would have a baseline of coverage?
If I were queen of the universe, that's what I would be pushing. I think that that is much more palatable to industry. I think that is much more palatable to a large segment of the population, and it doesn't feel as, you know, forced or decided upon as some people feel about Medicare for All. Again, Bernie Sanders' version of Medicare for All. I'm not queen of the universe, so no one has championed that approach. But if I were being a strategic politician and looking at the healthcare market and then looking at what its weaknesses are and then also what the hurdles are up against to change it, that's what I would do. I would describe some universal basic benefit and then have options of where you could get it. And then also have add-on benefits that you could purchase, and then low-income subsidies for people who are low-income.
And I think there are many other countries that have that model.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services, from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future, so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Ariel Kane is with us, Director of Healthcare, the Progressive Policy Institute. In the wake of COVID-19, we have seen various trends, and I want to run them by you and get your reaction to them. One is the acceleration by perhaps a decade of telemedicine. Now, telemedicine is being funded and supported by insurance companies now in the midst of the pandemic, but in many cases that was not subject to reimbursement at one point or another.
Telemedicine is complicated because it all just depends on who your insurer is and if your provider wants to participate and if your insurer wants to cover it. Of course, there's an expression, you know, as goes Medicare, so goes the commercial market, which means as Medicare makes policy changes, many of the commercial plans will then follow. Medicare has long had pretty strict rules around telehealth services for lots of reasons. One, they don't want overutilization of low-value care. And two, you know, it would be an easy area to have fraudulent services, which obviously Medicare has a responsibility to the taxpayer. And so they've been very slow to adopt telehealth services. There's a lot of rules around where you have to be in order to be eligible. You have to sometimes, you know, you're not eligible within your home. You have to go into a clinic, but then you can have a virtual appointment with a doctor that is physically somewhere else. There are licensure rules. What state is the patient in? What state is the provider in? And what are the rules that govern, you know, who can provide care when? However, it hasn't made a lot of progress. There's also, you know, from a consumer lens, you know, people aren't necessarily clamoring to make telehealth appointments. And so it's been a slow trek. But with COVID, all of a sudden, no one wanted to go into the office and providers still wanted to be able to see their patients. They still wanted to be able to get paid. And the Trump administration changed a lot of rules around what types of services could be covered, where the patient could be, some of the licensing rules. Again, all these changes that they did were in the Medicare market, but that makes it easier for the commercial market or the Medicaid population to follow. And then we'll see. You know, I think that we should do an evaluation after this is all over, and some of those changes should stay. I think patients should be able to get care in their home, and that should be covered by Medicare. I think that makes sense. However, I don't necessarily think that that appointment should be reimbursed at the same level as an in-person visit. If a patient never comes into the office, you don't have to clean anything. You don't have to sanitize surfaces, you know, replace tools, things like that, and we shouldn't be seeing those appointments as worth the same dollar value, which is one of the changes that the Trump administration made, is that they're currently being reimbursed equally.
Interesting. What about coming out of nursing homes and assisted living facilities? We've seen that this congregate living really lends itself to the spread of things like viruses. And I know there have been many advocates, one in the state in which I'm arguing that the money should follow the person, and that should follow the person into their own home if they want to stay there. What do you see as long-term care as a result of this?
Technology should help people stay in their homes as long as it makes sense. And, you know, I hope that telehealth can help move that needle along. However, you know, obviously nursing homes are necessary for people who need assistance with daily living. And we need to make sure that people can be safe inside of those facilities. And so that means stricter oversight. That means a really tight infection control procedures. And, you know, and yeah, I'm not sure I quite understand your follow the patient.
Well, the idea question. That if you can have a live-in person or a person who comes 8 hours a day, just to retain that person's place in their own home rather than going into a long-term care facility, that might be a better use of Medicaid and Medicare dollars.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And also, you know, helping people stay in their homes through technology. And, you know, direct care or home health aides, we need to value that industry. Currently, those are very low-paid jobs. If people work with a company, sometimes they sleep at a patient's house but then aren't reimbursed for that time because technically they were asleep and not providing care. They can work 3 days in a row. You know, it's not an easy job, but it's a job that we need people to do. And so whether that's putting more money through Medicare, where that's setting up, you know, a long-term care insurance program, you know, there are multiple ways to go about addressing this issue, but we have an aging population and more people are going to need those types of services. We need to protect patients by making sure that we're treating workers the way they deserve to be treated.
We talk about the elderly. We may be also at an inflection point as it relates to racial disparities. We did a podcast recently on the social determinants of health, and your zip code tells you a lot about the type of care you're likely to get, what may be available to you in your community. And of course, we have the other issues that have arisen in the midst of the pandemic about racial inequalities. Is this an inflection point on racial disparities in healthcare?
I mean, I would like to think that it is. I think that the conversation has changed and people are acknowledging that your health isn't just about your health insurance and it's not just about the personal choices that you make. It's about where you're born. It's about your education. It's about your access to transportation, your access to safety. And all of those things affect how a person, you know, lives their lives. And I think that if we ever want to have a healthier population, which is very clear the United States does not have a healthy population, we need to invest in the social services in which people, or the social services that support a healthy life. And that means education, transportation, food, streets outside, so you go outside and you know, not and have a place to play and get fresh air. Right. And because we spend so much money on the other side of healthcare, which is the hospital and you know, the doctor's office, the drugs, all of those things, we don't have enough money to invest in social services. So I do think we need to have this lens where we see investing in those social services as a long-term strategy to reduce overall healthcare costs and improve quality of life and acknowledge that, you know, race comes into that and where people live and, you know, how people are treated by police officers, all of that affects a person's health outcomes. And, you know, I think we're in this moment where we should be able to take action on it. And I hope that the healthcare industry would get on board and understand that that might mean less, you know, that might mean a global budget.
Does anyone recognize, I've seen a couple of doctors suggest that during the course of this pandemic, when we thought about the people who are most susceptible to it, we really weren't factoring in. I know we talked about the elderly and we did talk about race and the social determinants, but to the extent that we really didn't talk about obesity per se and people in their 30s and 40s who have high blood pressure, a whole range of comorbidity because of lifestyle, do you think we talked enough about that during the pandemic?
Yeah, because I think that we like to think that those issues are personal problems and that if someone was more disciplined or, you know, exercised more, then they would have health outcomes. And then it puts the blame all on the patient for their poor outcomes. And I don't really think that that's an effective way to design health policy or think about public health. You know, we need a society that makes it easier to be healthy. And of course, your own behavior plays into that. But currently, it is very hard to have a healthy lifestyle. And it is very hard if you're low income. And so, yeah, I think that obesity and high blood pressure and all those things matter. But I think they matter in the larger context of, again, how we see and invest in health in the United States.
Ariel, we know that drug affordability, something we touched on earlier, is a huge concern to so many people. Here we are in the midst still of this pandemic, and we're looking for antiviral drugs. We're looking for curatives of one sort or another, ultimately a vaccine. And yet we do know that ship and provide is going to be a big issue, and making sure that all Americans, or at least the vast majority, get this so we have herd immunity. Is that a point where we can have a conversation about drug prices again, based on the fact that everyone is going to want for our society to be fully back to work and back to where we were before? But it may require that everybody have access to these kinds of drugs or vaccines. So is this a moment to talk again about drug affordability?
Definitely. I mean, I think it's important to think about it in a number of ways. One, how do we scale up the production of a vaccine so quickly? You know, we're going to need it once we get a vaccine, which is no guarantee we even get it. But if we do, we're going to literally need billions of doses of that vaccine. And how do we scale and make that happen quickly? But then part of making sure that everyone can access it is making sure that it's affordable. I do think that, you know, this is a time where you could talk about preventative care, and, you know, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, they can make recommendations, which then insurance coverage will or won't cover based on, you know, the cost of the service. But then also, you know, the government has a role. And I think that, I don't know if it's negotiation, I don't know what exactly it is, but there is a role for the government to play when we talk about, you know, how much investment they have received and then what we get out of that at the end of it.
I know American Drugs, we did a whole podcast with Rosemary Gibson about bringing back manufacturing of drugs to the United States, and that seems to be occurring. There are some incentives already that the government is putting in place because our supply chain is very rickety and very susceptible to breakage. So that is another one of these areas. I won't get you into that, but I refer people back to our podcast with Rosemary Gibson. What about this era of healthcare preparedness? It seems like every time we have a public health crisis, we do focus on it for a bit, and then we walk away and say, well, I go to a clinic, I go to a physician, but we don't think enough and we don't invest enough upfront in healthcare preparedness. Do you think as a result of all this, we will be thinking much harder and longer about our investment in public health itself?
I mean, obviously, that's what I hope happens. And I think that, you know, local public health departments have long been underfunded and undervalued, and I hope that that changes. But, you know, time will tell. Like you said, we have the pattern of not necessarily learning from our mistakes and not changing. You know, you can just think back to Ebola or Zika. It was a fad for a summer and then it went away. I hope that this changes that, but I don't know.
And we also see another trend that is going on, and I don't know whether that will continue to occur in the wake of all of this, and that's allowing non-physicians like nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants play a much bigger role in care. That does, though, seem inevitable down the road.
I hope so. I think that, again, this comes to kind of state health policy. Scope of practice rules are all decided at the state level. And there's always a lot of battling in the state legislatures. Everyone wants to protect their turf of where they make their living. But I don't think that that serves the patient at the end of the day. And I think if people are trained to provide care, we should let them reimburse them for their services and cover them. So I hope that this does lead to change in that space. And I am optimistic, probably more so about that than long-term investment in public health, even though I would like to see that as well.
In closing, and maybe this is the elephant in the room, Ariel, but let's talk about it. And that's who makes money in healthcare and how they make it. And we've seen this incredible push, and we saw where we thought various systems of public and private health were going to break. New York City was trying to explain to us and the state of New York how complicated some of these systems are, or they're not systems at all, and that hospitals don't talk to each other and such. I mean, do we talk enough about where the money is going? If we all saw a pie chart as to where it's going, would we be surprised in healthcare?
I mean, the largest chunk of that pie is hospitals. And so that's a difficult area for politicians to say that hospitals make too much money. They're typically the largest employers in any given community. They, you know, most people have a lot of goodwill towards hospitals and much more animosity towards pharma companies and insurance companies. And so it's a political problem. I hope that we can just get to a place where we acknowledge we spend too much on healthcare and the way, and we're going to have to all get on board to reduce costs rather than pointing fingers, because even though hospitals may have the largest chunk of that pie, they don't have the highest profit margins. Pharmaceutical companies do. So everyone has a piece of it, and they're all clamoring for more. And I hope that we can realize that that's not, we spend so much money on healthcare and we don't even have good health. So we need to change how we distribute that pie and think about the investments that improve population health.
It'll be interesting to see also about the disparities that might arise or at least come to our attention as a result of COVID-19. We have seen urban areas most impacted to date, but there's been a spread in rural communities. And we know that many of the rural hospitals, as much as in many communities, they are sacred cows, and as you say, the largest employers. But so many of them have gone away in the recent period. It is remarkable to see the undercovered parts of our country.
We don't have an equitable system, and community hospitals are not doing well in the system that we currently have. I think there's a number of things at play. It's treating healthcare as a business versus a community service. You know, a lot of those smaller hospitals have been bought up by larger health systems who then see them as being not profitable and then and getting rid of them after they acquire them. Sorry, my dog is barking. I think that's one reason. I think another reason is just the population mix of rural areas. You might have more people covered by Medicaid and Medicare who reimburse less, and then they go to larger inner city hospitals for more expensive services. So if you're not getting the, you know, the cancer patients or the orthopedic surgeries, and you're just getting the sort of day-to-day primary care and you know, falls and cuts and broken bones, you know, and your hospitals have really high overhead. And I think that directly subsidizing them, we should be strategic. That should be an option, but we need to think about where does it make sense and what does a community hospital look like and what services make sense to have it there.
All right. Well, Ariel Kane, I want to thank you for being with us and really going around the horn today on a whole range of issues and looking at where hospitals and healthcare providers and the whole healthcare system may be on the other side of this pandemic. I really appreciate it. Here on America Trends, again, this is Ariel Kane, Director of Healthcare at the Progressive Policy Institute. If people want to go and find out more information on your site, it's PPI, is it, dot?
Yeah,
give us the site.
It's progressivepolicy.org. And we, you know, I have a lot of research there on telehealth and healthcare costs if people want to read more.
All right. Wonderful. Thanks again for being with us on America Trends.
Thank you so much.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofits.